Good morning. This is Jim Colburn, Commodity Research Group. I'm with Andy LeBeau, also of Commodity Research Group, and we are here to talk about energy markets. Along with Ed Meir, Andy and I founded Commodity Research Group, which consults on various aspects of commodity markets. Check out our website, commodityresearchgroup.com, where we post our monthly commodity reports, our daily metals reports, our blog, and our podcasts. We would also like to thank our friend Doug Stetzer of EKT Interactive Oil and Gas Training for hosting this podcast. You can check out his daily newsletter, podcasts, and learning modules at EKTinteractive.com. Today is Tuesday, February 7th. Andy, there's been a lot going on since our last podcast of about a month ago. So why don't we start by getting us up to date on OPEC compliance and U.S. Production response to that.
Okay, let's first start with the OPEC compliance, which has actually been strong, very strong. It looks like in January that OPEC reduced their production by, at least those who agreed to reduce production by 1.2 million barrels per day, are pretty close to a million barrels a day reduction. So that's about an 80%, 80% number, which is frankly more than what we thought. We had thought that it would be something like 0.7 or 0.8, but the Saudis reduced more than they said they would, and the Persian Gulf producers have also are right, just about right on their numbers. The producers who said that were not part of the deal probably increased their production by about 100,000 to 150,000, which means a net OPEC reduction of about 850 to 900,000. Again, that's about 200,000 better than what we had thought. So I think by and large, at least on the OPEC side, this production deal has really worked. I mean, they've done a good job so far anyway.
So Andy, we had a pretty good price response out of the meeting back in late November, early December. But when these OPEC compliance numbers were coming out, and I just felt like the market agreed with you and said it's better than we expected, but we really didn't get a strong, you know, follow through and price off of that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, prices did appreciate during the month of January, but you know, we're still as good as these production cuts have been. We're still fighting the same battle of high inventories. The IEA had inventories still at a 300 million barrel surplus, so I think that's one reason why the production, why prices probably didn't move all that much higher. And you know, as we're about to talk about it, it's still going to take some time to draw these inventories. And so, second, and getting to the next point, Jim, on U.S. production response. U.S. production has, at least looking at the weekly numbers, has increased by about 150,000 barrels a day from the end of December. So you know, that's a pretty big number.
And
basically counterbalances, if you look at non-OPEC, of which Russia is a non-OPEC producer. Russia did reduce its production by 100,000 barrels a day in January, but U.S. production more than counterbalanced that.
In today's EIA numbers, they updated their balance. You know, we've been talking about when is this market going to go into balance, and do you want to just talk about what their numbers show today?
Well, they're showing the market moving into balance sometime a lot sooner than they had. I mean, their last Their last EIA STO didn't have us in balance at all in 2017. This one is showing a first half, maybe second half balance. So they made some real benchmark revisions based on some of it's based on historical data. But I think the EIA is finally on the right track, because last month's numbers really didn't make sense looking at the supply and demand.
So just wanted to make a point on their demand number. They're looking for an increase in global demand of 1.6 next year. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And are you in line with that? Or are you
no?
No, you're.
I think that's too high.
It's too high.
I think it's too high. I think it's going to be something like 1.2 or 1.3 million barrels a day. I mean, we're off to a rough start here in the U.S. and the January Chinese numbers were soft. So I don't think we're gonna. I think 1.6 is way too optimistic. I think it's going to be 1.2, 1.3, which is more in line with OPEC and what the IEA is looking for.
Excellent. We're looking at today's market, and it's coming off hard. So I thought it might be a good time just to talk about the net length that's in this market by managed money. Do you want to just comment on that?
Yeah, I think one of the real, besides inventory length of, as I mentioned, 300 million barrels, there's also the speculative length, which is an overhang. If you look at the net length of WTI and Brent combined of the speculators, it's 850,000 contracts, which is 850 million barrels. So and both of those are record. Brent, the long to short, is around 12-1, and in TI it's like 8-1. What you really want to see, and that's long to short, what you really want to see is something like 3 or 4-1, you know. So we're way, way too long, and that really is an overhang. And I suspect that a lot of today's action is some long liquidation, and we'll see what the open interest is. But the speculative length is much too long.
Yeah, it just seemed to get ahead of the fundamentals by not anticipating, like you said, weak China demand, and as we'll get into it, maybe weak U.S. Product demand as well.
Right.
But let's look at the structure of this. So we have 850 million barrels of length in the hands of money managers. I mean, most of that's on the front end, correct? It would be like the first few months out. And then if they continue to be long, they'd be rolling into the next month. So they'd be selling the front month, buying a deferred month.
Right.
And just by that sheer volume alone, I would expect that to continue to put pressure on the front month spread. Obviously, the oil fundamentals are most important, but there's this extra huge flow of contracts that will pressure the front end for a while going forward, despite what the fundamentals are.
I think you're right, Jim. You throw in the fundamentals because we're about to. February is the peak U.S. turnarounds, and this year turnarounds are heavy. I mean, we'll be I think it's 1.2 million barrels a day of February turnarounds. So, you know, you're naturally going to be building stocks during the month of February. So I think, Jim, I think you're right on, because we'll be seeing this massive length running into supply increases in the mid-continent and in the Gulf Coast as refiners go into turnarounds or maintenances. So, yeah, I think there's real risk that the front end could get hit a little higher, hit a little harder.
Interesting. Okay, Why don't we talk about gasoline product demand? I mean, U.S. gasoline seems to be a tale of two pads.
A tale of two pads. That's pretty good. The gasoline has really been a major disappointment because inventories have just spiked over the last three or four weeks. Rising something 25 to 30 million barrels over just the last 4 or 5 weeks. And we're now at the point of 257 million barrels in inventory, where we're right near last year's peak, monthly peak of 261 million. And that served to ruin the whole gasoline season. It took months to get out from under the that type of overhang. And as Jim, as you were saying, that overhang is in pad one, where we're at a record, and pad three is also probably higher than it ought to be. Now, one of the reasons why this has happened is that the January demand was way off trend. So I don't think the January demand was right. And I think February will catch up and the monthlies will revise all that. So I actually do think there's a little more hope for this year's gasoline season than what we saw last year. But it's definitely, as I said, really a disappointment. I had not thought that we would get anywhere near last year's bloated inventory numbers. And why is demand soft? Part of it is probably in the data, but there probably is a little bit of a price response to high pump prices. Pump prices in January were 50 cents higher than year ago numbers. So I'm sure that there's some of that, but it shouldn't be as soft as it is. It's like 400,000 barrels a day below last year. And as we know, miles traveled is still on the upswing, and the fleet efficiency doesn't change all that much month to month.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the EIA described that it was a 57% decline in gasoline demand occurs seasonally, but this year it was a 50% larger decline than the 5-year average.
Right.
Demand, which is unbelievable.
Jim, exactly. It is unbelievable. That's why I don't believe it.
Well, I'm gonna check Netflix and see if there's any binge-worthy shows that came out during that period. I think that, you know, Domino's Pizza is doing really well. Netflix is doing well. So maybe people are just saying, you know, I'm staying indoors. And also the malls are getting killed. Nobody's going to the malls anymore. But even with that, 57% is just hard to believe.
Yeah, I don't think it's correct. I also think that the other thing that will happen is the Gulf Coast is gonna start draining because of export demand.
Export
demand, both to mostly to Latin America. I think in February and maybe into March, we're going to break the million barrel a day mark for a monthly average in February.
And we're talking gasoline demand. Is that, you think that's due to a pickup in the economy in Latin America, South America, or is it more refinery issues?
It's refinery issues. Mexico is still running probably, I think they're now under 50% capacity. So they're taking a lot of gasoline, and there are some other, major refinery issues in South America. So I don't think it's, you know, there's certainly some pickup in gasoline demand from, Latin America, but I think by and large, most of it is due to infrastructure problems.
I don't even want to bring up, we'll talk about this later, but this import tax is just going to mess up a major amount of flow of, you know, maybe the U.S. refineries are become less competitive on a world basis if they have to pay more for their inputs, but we'll talk about
get to that.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about distillate demand? Because we're also I want to say awash, but there's a lot of distillate around.
Yeah, there is. And again, a disappointment in January has got to be in distillate demand. I mean, last year we had a warmer than normal January. And actually this year, incredibly, temperatures in the Northeast were probably 2 to 3 degrees warmer than last year. So I think that hurt the distillate demand. I would expect that once we get out of season, distillate demand will be pretty strong. Mining and manufacturing is coming back, and the economy is still moving ahead, is still growing. So I think demand's going to pick up for diesel as we move into paradoxically, as we move out of season. And of course, we still have February and March ahead of us. But right now, the longer term forecast is a little bit warmer than normal. Now, the good news for diesel is that Europe had a much colder than normal December and into January. And what we saw was the arbitrage, the heating oil, the gas oil arbitrage collapsed with New York weakening relative to Europe. So we'll probably start seeing some decent export demand of diesel out of the Gulf Coast, and that'll help to drain the Gulf Coast, as will turnarounds. So I'm thinking products are going to be looking better as we head into March and April. U.S. products should be looking better. And the other big factor that we haven't talked about yet is that turnarounds, global turnarounds, are massive this year. Particularly Asian global turnarounds, I think in March and April are going to peak at something like 3.5 to 4 million barrels a day, and that's 1 million barrels a day more than usual, or more than last year. So we have these big turnarounds. It's going to tighten the diesel and probably the gasoline balances globally, and that certainly is going to help U.S. product. So that's going to be a really big factor. I think products look, they look horrendous right now, but you look out into March and April, I think they're going to be a whole lot better.
So this sloppiness that we see early on could be contributing to the sell-off. We go back to this large spec position. Maybe we get an exaggerated washout, but you don't think it's – so you see short-term weakness, but as you go further out, you don't see another, big collapse in this market. You see it starting to pick up again.
I don't. No, I think it is going to pick up. Now, the gasoline numbers are also too long in terms of the spec length, and heating oil is too long as well. So that's certainly a bearish factor. But I think the products markets, just based on fundamentals, are going to start showing improvement, and that certainly is going to help the crude market down the road. But as we talk about balancing the market, if we have these massive turnarounds in March and April, it means that product stocks may draw, but crude stocks are probably going to build, and there's probably still going to be a net build. So we really have to be looking. I know we've been kicking this can down the road for a long time, but we really have to be looking something like April, May, June, probably May, June, before we really start seeing some serious stock draws, and we really start an OECD. Inventories really start to draw heavily. And then it'll be just in time for the OPEC meeting on May 25th. But I think May, April, May is when we're going to really start the serious rebalance.
So do you want to venture, what's your price outlook for that time period going in? Let's say going into May, can you kind of,
I think the market's going to, now we've got some liquidation, the market's weaker than I really thought it was going to be, for right now, and that's because of some of the geopolitical developments, which I'm sure we'll talk about, Jim. But I think that as we head into the second quarter, we could see prices up into the near 60. I could see prices near coming back, maybe 50, you know, WTI 55, 57, Brent near 60. I think the market could hold together, and then you start that seasonal rally.
Right.
You start this little rally in the second quarter, and it'll be rallying for good reason. So, you know, let's get rid of some of this length, let the market reset. And, you know, in terms of the good things going on, I think, you know, this OPEC compliance is obviously a supportive development.
Right. And eventually they'll get into their summer, and maybe the Saudis will have a place to, you know, that'll help their demand as well.
Right. And we don't know what, you know, we don't know what second half is going to look like.
Exactly.
We don't know what, right. Really, you're just looking at you got to just do the first half, because we have no idea what OPEC's going to do in the second half.
Right. Well, it's interesting you bring up that $60 level. I mean, if you look at some of the, I was going to wait till later, but I'll bring it up now. If you take the LO options, the WTI options, the big open interest happens to be on the $60 calls in June and December. So the big one is December, like 47,500, and June has 42,000. So those are pretty good numbers. And I think that $60 number is, you know, if you're a producer, you sell it. If you're a speculator, maybe you buy it. I think that's what's been going. I think if you took the participants and looked at who was on the buy side, who was on the sell side, I think that's probably what you might, how it might break out net. And so we'll keep an eye on those and see if we can get up there and up by the time the June option goes off the board. Geopolitical risks. Let's talk about that. I mean, Iran, it sounded like for a couple of days there, people were just talking about Iran.
Yeah. And you had some people looking at like the DEIS 80 calls and the DEIS 100 calls. I think there were a lot of quoting on those as I understand it. And Iran is a big geopolitical risk. Last week we put Iran on notice, whatever that means. And we also imposed some more sanctions. Clearly the big issue is going to be the nuclear deal and where that goes. I think for now it looks like the new administration doesn't want to renege on the deal by any means yet. I think what they'd love is for Iran to renege on the deal, but our European allies certainly have been in favor of the nuclear deal, but you know, I don't think that deal is sacrosanct by any means, and you know, that's going to be I think that's going to be in play from time to time over the next few months, and we'll see if this, hopefully there's no military action, but as Jim, as you and I know, 40% of crude flows through the Straits of Hormuz, so that's that's a major choke point. You know, we'll see. You know, but that's clearly a major geopolitical flashpoint. The other thing to look at is Libya, because right now Libya is an important swing producer to a certain extent. They're not part of the deal. They're an OPEC producer, not part of the deal. And right now they're on the exports are on the way up. They say they want to get up to over 900,000 barrels a day this year from 3 or 4 last year. But you know, that could go either, that certainly can go either way.
Are you talking exports or production?
Production. But they are exporting now.
Right.
Most of that's going exports anyway, because the refineries are all screwed up.
So they're at around 700,000 now?
They're 690. Yeah, they're around 700. And they want to go up to 900.
And then their max output was around 1.2, something like that, or is it at post Gaddafi?
I think it was post Gaddafi. Yeah, I think that's right. 1.2. Maybe they got a 1.6 1 month, but I think 1.2 is yeah. So that's another obviously another producer to watch, as is Nigeria. Nigeria's production may go down in February because they have a big maintenance coming up on the Bongo field. So their production actually could go down. I think OPEC production is going to may go down slightly in February.
Well, at least that one's scheduled.
That's scheduled, right?
And then anything, one thing that we really never talk about is Venezuela. Is it just kind of middling? I mean, they're going to keep producing where they are. Are they going to decline?
I think we're going to see further declines this year.
Okay.
I think that they're probably going to go down in 100 to 200. They're obviously trying to, they've got some programs in place where they're trying to increase production, and but they failed so far. The country, as Jim, both of us know.
Yeah.
The country's been on edge for at least economically for years now.
Yeah, it's such a shame.
It really is. But I think this year they're set to decline. But that certainly is another geopolitical flashpoint.
Yeah, I just remembered a few years ago we were talking about flashpoints around the world, and somebody came up with Venezuela. We all kind of snapped our necks and said, "What?"
Right?
Because you forget about a country like that. Do you want to say anything about the potential import tax?
Well, let's talk about the potential import tax. We'll talk a little about it. We talked about it in our last podcast.
Yeah.
But obviously, this border adjustment tax could be a really major development in these markets, for the oil markets and actually for the global markets. Basically, it would be about a 20% difference for imports would be 20% higher than exports, which should theoretically raise the price of WTI by 20% relative to Brent. Again, that's all theory. I don't believe the theory is correct, but.
Yeah, it's there's also some economists are saying you'll see an equal move in the dollar.
Right.
Right. So, but that doesn't affect the relative value of say something like Brent and WTI, because you're actually slapping a tax on imported crude.
Yeah, you're slapping a tax on imported and not on on exported goods. So,
I mean, I was saying before, I thought maybe you could see something like some really heavy crude oil from Venezuela and from Canada get imported more because the tax would be lower, and then have the blenders blend it up to, I don't know, WTI quality, something, you'd see some weird things going on with trading. And I think you would also say to some of those East Coast Canadian refiners, you're going to be more competitive than us, our refiner, US refiners talking about, in Latin America and South America. So it gets back to what's the probability that something like that gets passed. And I just think there's going to be so much opposition, we're going to hear a tweet of something like, "Oh, that's too complicated."
Right. Which we've already heard.
Which we've already heard. Yeah.
I think that right now the banks are putting like 20 to 30% chance that this gets passed. But I think as it becomes more publicized and people start talking about how gasoline prices could could go up 20 or 30 cents a gallon. That's a real tough issue for a lot of for a lot of legislators.
It's an economy killer. Yeah,
it's an economy killer.
Yeah,
I don't think it would be exactly that though.
No,
First of all, if U.S. crudes are suddenly $10 more expensive than anywhere else, we're not going to export. No one's going to want our barrels, and exports are 700, so that could go to 200, and certainly there'll be a producer response. So I don't think it'll be, maybe TI will go $2 or $3 over Brent, but I don't think, maybe initially it'll spike before it comes off, but that $10 is a tough number.
And then who knows who has the president's ear, but there is an Exxon employee in the cabinet. So maybe if, I don't know if he's going to weigh in on energy or tax policy, but he certainly could.
Right. And Jim, as getting back to this border adjustment tax, there certainly has been a big play in the options, which we talked about last podcast, but I think it's even gotten bigger.
Yeah, just an update on that. We talked about the Dease 18, it's 2018 flat call on WTI Brent. So that means if you buy this thing, you're expecting WTI to trade over Brent, and that's basically what the import tax would force to happen, or would push in that direction in potentially a big way. And so there we see that right now there's about 50,000 contracts open on that one strike, which makes it by my eyeballing the largest option on the exchange in oil, and that's unheard of. It's a spread option. The big strikes tend to be the WTI options that trade the price outright. This is a relative value, WTI versus Brent. So it's just incredible to see that kind of volume come in on a trade like that. And now it's created its own sort of trading going on, because if you're short that call and that spread starts moving up, you if you're a market maker, you have to take some protection against that. So you might actually buy the spread as it starts moving towards your strike. So basically it creates its own dynamic, and it seems to have quieted down. But those contracts aren't going away for a while. They will still be there. But since you opened up the door for options, I'll just make a couple of comments. Really, since the end of the of November, early December, after the OPEC meeting, this option market has gotten very quiet. Implied volatility is around 27, 28%. It's probably a little higher today. And this is the lowest level since before the OPEC meeting. And I'm talking about the OPEC meeting in 2014. Okay, so that's the one before we, it was a disaster of a meeting, and just before that, we were around 27. Actually, it's about a month earlier in that month. We were right around these levels. So it's been a while that we've been down this low, and like you said, if you look at what the price level is, pretty close to where we were after the OPEC meeting. So we've been chopping around. And there's been a lot of talk, but we are pretty much waiting for the next, event to come up. We're in the same place price-wise. So it makes a lot of sense that vols have come in. And if we look at the structure, we still see the sort of the $45 and $50 puts have the most open interest going out through the year. And on the call side, it's the $55, $60 calls. And if you're a producer, you can see you probably wouldn't mind selling a $55 or a $60 call. You'd love to sell your oil up there. And you want to buy a $45 put to protect if things go the other way. And we mentioned the spread options already. Just to repeat, the minus 50 put from March to June has been active. the minus 25 put from July to D, so this is 2017, has the most open interest, and the flat call from March through D17 is the most active. And that makes sense. Figure minus 50 cents is where storage becomes profitable, and flat calls when we flip from contango to backwardation. So there's a lot of interest in those particular points. What else? The only thing I'd say is, you know, just you really have to be careful. I mentioned there was a piece in one of my favorite blogs, Marginal Revolution, on the VIX, and they talked about how the VIX is so low despite the new president doing all this, tweeting and all the activity in the new White House trying to figure it out. And meanwhile, the VIX is at a very low levels. And I actually commented on that blog, and I said, you know, just consider going back to 2014 when implied volatility in June of that year was at record low levels. It got down below 13%. And when I say record, I'm going back to 1986 when options started trading on the exchange. So it's a long time. And then later that year, volatility is up around 50%. So you can't, these numbers tell you where we are today. You really aren't good at forecasting what's going to be happening going forward. Okay, that's enough on options. Anything else you want to add, Andy, to what do we miss?
Well, I think just in terms of structure, as we said earlier, the front end has some downside, and I think that we're going to see the curve is already beginning to weaken. The DSRED DS, which was flat, is now moving into minus. I think it's minus 50, minus 60, maybe even more than that. So we are beginning to see the curve weakening, and we may see that over the next couple of weeks. So those speculators that have been playing for backwardation in the first half of the year, you know, that hasn't worked so far.
No.
Maybe as we head into the second half, those will do a little bit better. But the other interesting thing is that while the net length has really increased, the net speculative length, the producers have really not been selling so far this year. They've been really quiet. You haven't really seen a big growth in producer shorts down the curve. I think they sold the spike at post OPEC meeting, but they've been pretty quiet. So they still have plenty of firepower. You know, as this market, when and if this market turns, I don't get the sense that they're going to sell it into the hole here. You know, I think they'll be patient, but most of the action that we've been seeing in the market has been probably spec length, maybe some dealer selling into it, but the producers have been quiet.
That's very interesting. As we know, producers are probably the eternal optimists when it comes to price forecasting. There's always a rally around the corner, and that may have something to do with it. They're probably feeling pretty good about the market finally after a tough couple of years. And but I think you're right. You saw some of that flurry right after the meeting. Maybe they put a tranche on and just are waiting for the next price target level, which may be around $60. So
yeah, I think they were very active in December, but January they just haven't been there.
Yep. Good stuff. Okay, let's finish it off. This is Jim Colburn. I'm with Andy LeBeau. We're at commoditysearchgroup.com. Check us out.